Okay, so Bjorn gave me the following charge to give a tutorial lecture about information theory and also about geophysical vortices. And I just wanted to make a couple of comments from Mike's lecture, which I thought was really a great lecture, for the people in the audience, just so they'll see where some connections might come up. So Mike emphasized in part of his talk that waves in the tropics are very important for hurricanes. They're also very important for predicting our weather in mid-latitudes a few weeks down the line, et cetera. And one of the things we're going to talk about in the meeting on Wednesday and on Friday are waves and multi-scale effects in the tropics, which, just to give you some connection, and that's something I'm heavily involved in, but which I won't talk about today. So this isn't exactly the title of my talk, it's from another talk. But what I want to show you in these tutorials, and again, I'm like Mike, please stop and ask me any questions during the talk. What I'd like to do is show you how you could use ideas from information theory in two different ways. One is to actually let you think about a different way with important quantities such as angular momentum to predict behavior of vortices that are intense geophysical vortices without looking at the detailed dynamics. And then the second thing Bjorn gave me a charge to is on Thursday we have a day devoted to how to do ensemble predictions and their predictability and their characteristics. And what he asked me to do was to also discuss how information theory might be relevant and useful for ensemble predictions. So I'm going to talk about those two very different topics. So what is information theory? Well, it goes back to Shannon in the late 40s, Claude Shannon, looking at the information of signals. It goes back to Boltzmann in the area of statistical mechanics. So let me just tell you what it is. It turns out that axiomatically, up to a constant multiple, there's a unique functional which measures the average lack of information in a probability measure. So a probability measure is a non-negative mass function, and you integrate it, it integrates to one. And that functional is the absolute entropy. So it measures the average lack of information in a probability measure. Now my beginning of the tutorial starts with a fact everyone knows. Everyone knows a famous probability distribution, the bell-shaped curve. So the bell-shaped curve is a Gaussian probability distribution. It's given here. I've centered it so its mean is zero. And its variance, sigma squared, is given by its second moment. Now, virtually everyone, even if you know nothing about probability theory, you know that this is a universal distribution. Whenever you measure the mean in the second moment, this is the distribution that's most likely to come up. In fact, if you take sums and combinations of variables that have the same mean and the second moment scaled correctly, their limit, according to the central limit theorem, is a Gaussian. So it's kind of a universal probability measure. So the first thing you'd think about is, suppose I give you a zero mean and a second moment, and I ask the question, which probability measure has the biggest lack of information? In other words, is the least biased probability measure with the zero mean and the second moment. Well, without knowing anything, you'd guess it would be this Gaussian measure amongst the class of all these probability measures, just for the reason I mentioned. So what you might ask is, the one that is the least biased probability measure is the one, SP star, that has the largest lack of information given the constraints of the mean and the variance. I'll prove for you rigorously, this is the only thing I'll prove in this lecture, is that P star is P Gaussian. That's what I'll prove for you in a few lines. So an important concept from information theory, which we'll be using in the lecture, is the relative entropy. So the absolute lack of information in a probability measure just starts with a probability measure. Usually you have some prior information. That will be given by a probability measure pi. So that will express some information you have without, called a prior, without knowing much else in the system. We'll see several examples in my lecture when we do that. And then you might ask, given this prior probability measure pi, what is the average lack of information in the probability measure pi compared to a probability measure p? It turns out again that there's a unique functional that does this job. This is called the relative entropy. So if pi happened to be 1 and I had a minus sign here, it would be the absolute entropy. But this is now the relative entropy. And that's called also the Kullback-Leibler distance by mathematicians. In case some of the mathematicians in the audience have heard of it, we'll call it the relative entropy here. So it measures the average lack of information in a probability density pi compared with p. Now you can show mathematically using the convexity that this is a non-negative function. It's bigger than 0 unless p equals pi. And of course, a very nice property it has is that it's invariant under changes of variables. So in applications, the way this comes up is pi reflects prior knowledge, and you add additional information through c. And then the way you might want to pick the p star you have is the least biased probability measure. So that, in other words, given our prior information, when we add more information, it should have the least bias beyond it. So what it ought to do is do what I said here, minimize. I hope people in the back can see the bottom of my slides right now. So it should measure. So given pi, if I add additional information through other constraints, our prior knowledge, then the one I should pick that is the least biased probability measure for doing further statistical measurements should be the one that has the smallest additional information compared to pi, but incorporates the constraints. That's encoded here. So these two principles of maximization of information and minimization of bias given a prior distribution are at the heart of what I'll be talking about. I'll be using them in rather different ways than traditional uses in information theory by putting physics into these things. So now, what I want to do is prove for you the claim that as far as absolute information, if I have the constraints of a zero mean and a second moment, there's a unique one that maximizes the absolute lack of information of this probability measure, and that's the Gaussian. Let me prove that for you. So here's the way the proof goes. So what I do is use the fact that if P is not the Gaussian, the relative entropy of P measured with the Gaussian is bigger than zero, then I write it like this. Now let me expand the logarithm as ln of P over ln of P Gaussian. So I get P ln of P. Then obviously the Gaussian has the constant, which puts it in here. And then if I look at the Gaussian and take the logarithm, I then get the logarithm of the exponential part, which is the variance. That's lambda squared, sigma squared. Now, look at what I have. P isn't any old probability measure. It's the probability measure with the same mean and second moment as the Gaussian. So this is it integrates to 1, so this is the same as for the Gaussian. And this second moment is the same as for the Gaussian. So what I'm using is this identity that this, for a probability measure p that has the same mean and the same variance as the Gaussian, is the same as the integral for the Gaussian. And this happens to be minus the entropy of the Gaussian. So what I end up with is that S of P Gaussian minus S of P, then, this is an identity, is bigger than zero. So that says that the absolute entropy of the Gaussian is bigger than the absolute entropy of any probability measure with the same mean and second moment, that's not the Gaussian. That's what we're doing. I'm sorry? This is by far the world's easiest proof. I invented it myself. There are proofs in the literature that are much older that take 15 pages to do, honestly. This is my own little argument. Thank you. I do make it look easy.
Okay. You didn't pay me to say that, by
the way. Thank you. Yeah. Flattery will get you nowhere as we go. So what? Okay. So that's right. So the applications of information theory and atmosphere ocean science are just really burgeoning, and this is really a very natural set of tools for all of these problems. And I'd just like to mention a few things. I actually have a whole book devoted to these topics, and I'll tell you some of the ideas. It's a book with Xiaoming Wang, who's here at the meeting, just came out in Cambridge Press. The triumph of the book is we can use ideas from information theory and start with the inputs of the mission, the two space missions that looked at Jupiter, namely the input of the Galileo mission, which probed the small scales in the depth of Jupiter, come up with a prior distribution, and then predict the large scale behavior, and it'll be consistent with the Voyager mission. It will actually predict why Jupiter's red spot is at 22.5 degrees south. I know no theory in this complex zigzag jet pattern. I know no other theory that does it. This isn't the perfect theory. It's the only theory, however, that's consistent with the observational record and predicts the red spot where it should be as a giant anticyclone, consistent with the observational record we know. So that's one of the applications in the book. There have been other nice applications, which I've reinterpreted using information theory to topographic stress. I'll show you one today about deep open ocean convection. There's been nice work by one of the speakers at the meeting, Marcos Katsoulakis, where if you coarse-grained stochastic lattice models, you might ask how much information is lost systematically in that coarse-graining process. And he has very nice work using information theory. Well, I told Richard Kleeman about some of these ideas a number of years ago. And Richard Kleeman, who's also at this meeting, who heads our prediction efforts really at the Quran Institute, and I owe Richard's getting me interested in these areas. I taught him about the relative entropy, and he said that this is a very natural kind of distribution when you want to take an ensemble prediction and measure how much skill there is in the ensemble prediction beyond the climatology. So your prior knowledge is the climatology. And he got me started and a group of people around me doing that. So in particular, at the end of my talk in predictions, a very important practical topic is how with small ensemble sizes you can detect non-Gaussianity and routes of multiple events and predicted ensemble predictions. That's the work I've been involved in. Then a very natural new topic, which is very exciting, is suppose you have a subspace. It might be the low-frequency subspace in the atmosphere. For people who are atmospheric science experts, the low-frequency patterns like the NAO, PNA, AO. And you do ensemble predictions, and of course you're interested in what's happening in an extended range, you might want to know how much information is flowing into those principal components in an ensemble prediction, and how does it reduce the uncertainty in those components. There's a very nice natural topic of information flow among subspaces, and Liang and Kleeman worked out a very nice theory that only applied to one-dimensional subspaces, both essentially a two-dimensional theory. And one of my postdocs is here at the meeting, John Harlan, and I have been working on it, and really we found a suitable multi-dimensional practical extension of these ideas for how information flows along subspaces recently. Another nice place where information theory is starting to raise its head is again on a topic from Thursday, where doing ensemble filtering, you'd like to know how to reduce uncertainty in ensemble filtering in various ways. And Gregory Eanth, who was originally invited to come to this meeting, couldn't make it, has been thinking of using information theory and ensemble filters. And John Harlan will give a talk Thursday showing how you can avoid a very important problem of filter divergence in ensemble filtering and using some ideas, again, recent ideas. And finally, I want to mention, and this is very, very new and very nice work, so there is a kind of moment strategy I'll be talking about for increasing the information content. And Adam Monahan, who's from the University of Victoria and is involved with the Canadian Climate Center, has done some very beautiful work on looking at the probability distributions for the surface winds around the globe. And people had an empirical distribution, the Weibull distribution they wrote down, which was given by some strange set of empirical formulas in the usual way, which he found worked well in some regions of the planet and worked not very well in other regions of the planet. But what he found out, he heard us talk about information theory, is if you use the moment tools we've developed in the investigations in two, you actually get a very nice, globally accurate picture for what the PDFs of the surface winds look like. So those are the kind of emerging applications that are going on with these ideas. And as I said, I actually have two books where these ideas are discussed in various ways. I think they're really interesting ideas for a lot of places and by no means exhaustive. So the basic ideas in nonlinear dynamics and statistical theories for basic geophysical flows, where you'll see the information theory done from scratch, are in a book of mine and Xiaoming Wang in Cambridge Press. I also have another book where I talk about information theory and stochastics and fluctuation dissipation theorem, which is a lecture notebook. And finally, for the mathematicians, I taught myself, I didn't know anything about rotation and stratification 12 years ago. I moved to the Crown Institute. I was lucky enough to give courses in anything I want. That's how I generated all these books, by the way. And I taught myself atmosphere ocean by writing up a set of lecture notes from Brown, where I taught myself the subject. And this might be interesting for some people who don't know about it. But what I'll be saying, a lot of it can be found in here or in here. So, what does information theory have to do about vortices and predictions? So what you should think of is making predictions by having some prior knowledge, using that prior knowledge, and giving you, perhaps with some other external constraints, a cheap way to predict the behavior of a system. So what I want to show you today is tailored to address what Bjorn asked me to do, how you can use angular momentum and understand, again, without doing detailed dynamics, using ideas from information theory, how to predict intense geophysical vortices. So the intense geophysical vortices I'm going to talk about, you can just view as a model. This won't really be much about, won't have much directly to do with hurricanes. It turns out that there's an extremely important analog of hurricanes happening in the ocean. Happens in the polar oceans. And it's the cold air outbreaks of sinking water from cold air outbreaks over the Weddell Sea, the Greenland Sea, and the Labrador Sea. And there was a major field campaign in the middle 90s, which John Marshall from MIT got me interested in right when they were ending the field campaign. So I got interested in the field, everyone else left the field, honestly, is what happened, because all the money.
Well, there's two ways to
look at
that.
I mean,
they got scared.
Yeah, sure. So anyway, this is a very fascinating problem, but it has the same kind of analog of what Mike Montgomery was talking about deep towers sinking. So there's an analog of deep convective towers. These are plumes sinking. There's a fundamental difference. The Rossby radius, the radius where the ocean is important, where rotation is important in a given fluid, in these polar environments, is 6 kilometers or 10 kilometers. So what we're going to have is rotationally dominated plumes, unlike this very subtle mixture that Mike talked about, where you have very weak rotation, essentially none on the smallest hot tower scales, and you have a preconditioning environment. One thing that will emerge also is the importance of the preconditioning environment, all of the discussion I'll talk about today. So actually, I intend to use similar ideas for the hurricane formation problem, thanks to Mike again and a set of lectures I had him do at a set of workshops I ran last year at NCAR. He got me very much interested in the hurricane genesis problem, and we have new multi-scale models for that, for which these ideas can be applied, I think. So here's kind of a statistical mechanics thinking. The nice way about what I'll be talking about with these methods is they'll be eventually lifted from not requiring the statistical mechanics hypothesis to be satisfied. But so you could see from Mike's talk, a driving question is, you have some kind of elementary motion, a hot tower, and how do such intense small-scale activities create a statistically averaged large-scale structure? And I'll ask those questions under constraints of energy and, of course, angular momentum. That's a very natural constraint for a hurricane
to think about, since angular momentum plays a big role. These fluxing inward of angular momentum spins up hurricanes. So the outline for this part of the talk, and obviously I've glued together a bunch of lectures, will be the theory of equilibrium statistical mechanics, given the background I told you a little bit about, in a way to view it without being an expert in equilibrium statistical mechanics in an empirical way. And then I'll show you a little bit about the predictions of the statistical mechanics of hetons. Hetons are a very beautiful elementary particle type concept introduced by Stammel, a famous oceanographer from Woods Hole, which represent, for the analog of the hurricanes in the polar oceans, the elementary small-scale sinking. You can flip things upside down and you'll get rising motion, except that it will be rotationally constrained here. And then I'll show you how you can apply this to get coarse-grained predictions without doing detailed dynamics, which are at least qualitatively in line with doing very detailed simulations of the same phenomena. So first I'll tell you what a heton is. So this is kind of the elementary particles you'd think of that would randomly interact in a fluid. So what a heton is here is from a very nice paper of Sonia Leggett and John Marshall from JPO of 93. They ran a non-hydrostatic complex fluid simulation of putting some cold water here and having a cold air outbreak here and having the water sink. So what it tends to do is, after it sends off waves and does all sorts of other things, it adjusts to a balance state where the cold water eventually raises the isopycnals associated with the cold water part. It spins as a cyclone in the upper part of the atmosphere, in the upper part of the ocean, and a anticyclone in the lower part. If we turn this upside down, it would be just like a mid-latitude, a mid-troposphere heated tower that would be a cyclone in the lower atmosphere and an anticyclone in the upper atmosphere. But I'm going to stick with the oceanic analogy. So here, unlike the atmosphere, rotation is important on the smallest scales. And what Leggett and Marshall did is they learned from Stammel that maybe they should consider this very complicated event and make a radical approximation, which is often done in atmosphere-ocean fluid dynamics, of quasi-geostrophic dynamics, and then do one of Stammel's hetons. So what a heton is if you're a mathematician, it's like a point vortex. It's a point vortex in a two-layer model, and in that two-layer model, the analog of this, so you're going to get the details of this very rapid time equilibration as raising up the isopycnals of cold water. That's natural. You had a cold water sinking event, and that locally should have raised up the isopycnals of cold water after it's done. Isopycnals are constant density curves. So you've done that. And then what you've done is you spin up simultaneously a little cyclone here and a little anticyclone there. So it's the cartoon of what's happened here. You see this is highly non-quasi-geostrophic. The isopycnals, the density contours have scrunched way up. We're going to commit a common abuse. Many of our distinguished members of the audience make this abuse all the time, or our atmosphere ocean people are making this quasi-geostrophic. That's a simple model.
Why is the scale? The anticyclone, pretty much the same as the scale of the cyclone. parking lot is in the cycles.
So this is a constant buoyancy frequency. Partly, let me tell you why. It's Rossby radius confined. These are the Rossby radii. The Rossby radius here is a few kilometers. This is an exaggeration. Right here, this is on the Rossby radius. So you don't get the strong, powerful outflow moves to and the asymmetry from the Earth. Okay, so that's going to be our elementary particle. And so what we're going to eventually look at is, why are these gadgets interesting? So if I took that upright heat pad, not much would happen. But if it would just sit there as a steady exact solution of a point vortex system, which you'll eventually see me write down. But if I tilt it a little bit, and it might tilt by interaction with others, it'll start propagating. And that tilting will transport heat. So it's a way to transport heat. And again, this is Stammel's idea, and here's the formula for how it transports heat. Given its strength, separation distance, and tilt, there's a speed. Here it is. Okay, so what we're going to think about is just like when Mike was talking about hot towers, we're going to have, in some domain, a whole bunch of these hot towers create a bunch of convective elements. And we're going to ask, in which preconditioned environments will these form a very nice large-scale vortex, and predict that on the basis of angular momentum and energy without doing the detailed calculation. That will be our goal. Now, what I need to do is give everyone some idea of where you might think how you might begin to do that. So let me start with the simplest model for this lecture, which is a one-layer quasi-geostrophic model, just to pin things down. So here's the beta effect of Earth. Here's the effect. Here's the Rossby radius to the -2. Here's topography. We're not going to use those things. Here's the two-dimensional vorticity equation. Here we're damping it and forcing it. In equilibrium statistical mechanics, people throw away the effect of damping and throw away the effect of forcing and ask, what are the relevant conserved quantities? So let's do that here. So here's a little bit of a tutorial. So by the way, if you don't have beta, you don't have F, and you don't have H, you have two-dimensional fluid flow, and this is why atmosphere ocean people often say that two-dimensional fluid flow is a good model for various large-scale things. And in my book, and in Joe Pedlosky's book, and Adrian Gill's book, etc., you'll find discussion of why these are good models. I just want to point out, and I emphasize this in my book, you'll be astonished if you're a mathematician and not an atmosphere ocean scientist, what an enormously important role beta plays and H plays in the dynamics. Harmless-looking lower-order terms to a mathematician are changing the dynamics enormously compared to two-dimensional flow. My book tries to make that clear for mathematicians. So this notion of predicting solutions with equilibrium statistical mechanics has a long history. So Ansager, part of his Nobel Prize citation, a significant part of it was for his point vortex theory, for predicting how you might get a big vortex from small-scale point vortices for such a model with no beta and no topography. Just for people to realize, there's a beautiful mathematical theory making Ansager's work rigorous due to Cagliotti, Pierre-Louis Lyons, Marchiori, Poveretti, et cetera, from that era, and independently due to Kiesling. And Pierre-Louis Lyons and I have generalized with completely new phenomena that theory to nearly parallel three-dimensional telemetry. Turns out, I'll just point out, are a cartoon for what happens at rapidly rotating Maynard convection, where you get nearly parallel cyclonic filaments. And actually, this is a pretty good model for that. Independently, I see what I should do. I'm sorry, I'm a little out of place for discussing the history. So what does equilibrium statistical mechanics try to do? Before I go through the history, I realize I had one slide out of place here. Apologize for that. What all the theories of equilibrium statistical mechanics try to do is make predictions based on ignoring the dissipation and ignoring the forcing. Then that system, you can easily show, has a conservation of energy principle. This is the kinetic energy. And then if you dump the dissipation and forcing, it's also got conservation of an infinite number of functionals which you integrate the vorticity, the so-called potential vorticity for any G over your domain. And then the quadratic one was singled out by some people. That's called the entropy. That's the quadratic one. So now, getting back to my history of equilibrium statistical mechanics, so people try to make predictions based on those conserved quantities. There's been an enormous disagreement from people going on endlessly. And these three groups, so I have worked in turbulence theory of engineering sorts for about 20 years. And I learned there that people think turbulence is the study of viscous incompressible flow, but it's really the study of vicious incomprehensible flow.
Are you saying you're vicious?
I said it's the study of that. I'm not vicious. I'm a gentle soul underneath it all. Those who know me well know this. Okay. Well, I got interested in what I thought was the backwater area of turbulence theory, only to find out that this group hates this group, hates this group, and they all mutually dislike each other. So, of course, I jumped in. And I jumped in with Bruce Turkington. And what we had is, of course, we came up with a new theory with a few robust conserved quantities. So this is a very nice theory due to first Bob Kraken, but the effects of topography, et cetera, are really significant. There's a very pretty paper of Rick Salmon. And they declared the energy and the entropy were the only important conserved quantities. There were some mathematicians who wanted to work with infinitely many conserved quantities. That's pretty dangerous for practical problems, since you can't make an infinite number of measurements. And what I want to show you is all of these things can be demystified by an empirical information theory prediction principle. That's put in my book. So here's the unifying principle, and I came up with this with Bruce Turkington and a whole bunch of different contexts, although I think it's first really written down in my book. All of those theories are special cases of the following very simple empirical theory. And the advantages of the empirical one is you can use it like crazy and use it not in the places, for example, which strictly satisfy the hypotheses of equilibrium statistical mechanics. So now think back to my first slides. What we're going to start with is a prior distribution. It's going to be a probability measure. It's going to measure the small scale fluctuations in potential vorticity. In other words, the 1-point statistics. So pi zero integrated between alpha and beta gives you the probability that the vorticity, potential vorticity, is between alpha and beta. We're going to have a series of large scale constraints in various problems. They might be your energy, your circulation, your angular momentum, and your impulse. I forgot to list angular momentum here. In my talk later on, there'll be the energy, the angular momentum, and the circulation. Okay. Then what we're going to do is view any probability measure that's a candidate for the 1-point statistics at large scales. So these are extremely simple theories. They start with small-scale 1-point statistics, give you large-scale 1-point coarse grain statistics without worrying about correlations between elements. That's both a strength and a weakness of the theories. So what we can do now is generalize the relative entropy I wrote down in the first few slides to such a situation. It's a very easy generalization. We've got probability measures parameterized by our domain called omega. We take the old relative entropy, integrate it over the probability measures, and then integrate an average. The slash means you just divide by the area of the domain, and that's your entropy. So that you can show mathematically as the natural guy. This morning I saw a little typo on one of my old slides. So what we're going to do is, just as we predicted the Gaussian under various circumstances, we're going to find the P star, given our prior information, pi zero, which reflects our small scale guess for what's happening to the vorticity. We're going to find the large scale distribution P star for the coarse grain variable by maximizing this S, or minimizing P relative to P star, where we add the constraints of energy and circulation. Now, a very beautiful thing happens. If I look at the mean of this large scale probability measure, that's the mean potential vorticity, it'll solve a nonlinear elliptic equation, which depends on our constraints and the solution. I'll show you what that looks like in general. Now, if all's right in the world, if pi zero starts out to be Gaussian, then the theory I should get should be as simple as possible. So the large scale probability distribution you predict should be Gaussian, and the nonlinear elliptic equation should be linear. And that's what happens. So the theory of Rick Salmon and everyone else, to just foreshadow what I'll tell you later on, just comes up if you make a trivial approximation that pi zero is Gaussian, you'll end up with the energy entropy theory, and this will be a linear equation.
Okay. So now. That's right, and then look at the large scale results and see when you plug in additional information, is it consistent with those large scale features? And that's the success. We put in the right prior distribution for, based on the Galileo mission, which actually involves deep convection banging on the weather layer. But that yields an anticyclonic skewness in the small scales on the weather layer. And out will pop the Great Red Spot, by the way, from that at 22.5 degrees. It has nothing to do with it here. So that mean field equation I wrote down is at every point x.
But when you couple with your run, you make an average.
That's right. So I think what you're asking is, you could think of, for very general probability distributions where you allow correlations, a bigger entropy that measures correlation information too. This is the one that measures only the one-point statistics in the field by design. So in the book, there are more elaborate things. That's actually a good question.
So here's how the formulas look. So Mike anticipated what I was going to say for that one layer equation to focus on. And here's your large scale equation that you solve. So it's a nonlinear elliptic equation given your constraints. And here's your prior probability distribution. So if you know statistical mechanics, it has a very beautiful interpretation. You take the prior probability distribution. This is the Laplace transform of that prior probability distribution, which is called the generating function of your probability distribution. The logarithm of it is called the cumulant generating function. And the nonlinear elliptic equation you get is the derivative g prime evaluated at these arguments of the cumulant generating function.
So g is like a partition.
That's right. So you have a very, very pretty set of formulas and make a prediction pi here, you then can look at your large scale states again.
Okay, so all of these things in equilibrium statistical mechanics, as far as people doing turbulence, have always been considered, including by me, until the last 8 or 10 years, very strange, exotic things. And there has been some very nice confirmation in a paper in work by David Montgomery, not Mike here, a man much older, David Montgomery from Dartmouth University, who's a plasma physicist. He has a group that did a very nice confirmation in decaying turbulent flows. One of the problems with seeing a confirmation of equilibrium statistical theories of decaying turbulent flows is, if you look at my book, you'll find out that there are competing theories called selective decay theories that can give you exactly the same answers. You don't know whether this is a decaying situation, whether it's a fortuitous agreement, or whether there's really anything. On the other hand, Mike has talked himself
in his early part of his talk, in his lecture this morning, and I don't need to mention this to the people doing atmosphere ocean science, but for the people who hear about turbulence in the math community, they usually hear about decaying turbulence. Flows where you force them at large scales, and there's a cascade to small scales. But in fact, almost all of our environmental flows have a significant portion of energy going upscale to the large scales. And not only that, the problems people struggle with is, say, if you have a 100 kilometer mesh in a general circulation model, you've got turbulence you've cut off on all those scales. Even if you have 1 kilometer meshes, you've got turbulence you've still cut off at all those scales. 250 meter meshes, you've got turbulence at all these scales. And you really have to think about what's happening as energy goes upscale. So we had a little different point of view, and we was a collection of nice postdocs. I had Marcus Gordon, Mark DiBattista from the late 90s, started to try to think about these, is it possible to use equilibrium statistical mechanics to represent the large scale effect of an inverse cascade, provided there's a fairly weak rate of transfer of energy to the large scales. And I'll show you a typical simulation of the type we did. And Xiaoming Wang and I even managed to do a rigorous proof for those who are mathematically inclined. That'll be, I think, roughly half of Xiaoming's lecture next Wednesday at this meeting. We'll talk about other interesting statistical work he's doing. But what I want to show you is a typical simulation where the result will be a large-scale coherent vortex that looks like a prediction of equilibrium statistical mechanics with enormously high precision. So now I'm going to do two-dimensional fluid flow. And I'm going to have Newtonian viscosity, and I'm going to have a very coherent small-scale forcing. So you can think of the Heaton problem or the hot tower problem in some baby cartoon here. So what we're going to do is have a bunch of times and force at various different times by a small-scale intense vortex. So this is Mike's analog of a hot tower or a deep open ocean convection plume and much more complicated systems. And here's the formula for it, but we're going to pick these guys xj at random from a uniform distribution in our swimming pool basin. And this is from Xiaoming Wang's in my paper, just because this is the simplest case, and this is a case where we have a theorem proving this. So what we have is one intense vortex here, and then we're going to keep bombarding the fluid with all these intense vortices, and then we have forcing them, this extremely small-scale intense forcing, and then dissipation. What do we get? Well, you go through a period of time T equals 1, there were 10 vortices bombarding your fluid.
This is 2D, right?
2D, just two-dimensional, absolutely two-dimensional. 50 vortices have bombarded your fluid by this time, 100 by this time, so you can see. This is 1,000 by time 100, and you see what's emerged, these are the streamlines of your fluid flow. You're starting to see something. This will never settle down to an exact equilibrium. There will always be forcing and noise in the system. But you see something that's emerging that looks fairly large scale with these intense little peaks in it.
Are these 1 over R?
No, they have a very special form that I wrote down which are irrelevant for the details.
But they're single sign.
They're single sign. That's the key thing Harry got here. And we've done cases with single sign and without single sign, but the reason why I'm giving this case is this is the one case where we could prove a theorem. Okay. So we've done extensively mixed sign cases that are, for example, discussed in my book. So now if you look at the vorticity, it's what you would think is happening. So at the end here, you're starting to see something regularize into a large-scale structure with occasional peaks coming out. And you can see that settles down. So if you look at the energy, it statistically settles down. By time 100, that was the peak of where it starts settling down. And here's where the math theorem enters. we can prove rigorously that you settle down to something that always looks like fluctuations about a certain steady state. And that steady state is the steady state of energy entropy equilibrium statistical mechanics, to very high accuracy.
You know, I think there's an interesting idea here. Consider bombarding this vortex. You get into this equilibrium regime where the energy stays basically constant.
Yeah, sorry.
Yet the vortex, the wind is supported by the vortex, which is not good. They develop small scale jet like structures.
They do.
And, you know, there's a very interesting problem of the staircase, or whatever you want to call it, structure that may emerge in the jet type flow. It makes sense in scales.
So we've done these sorts of things with jets and with blocking flows that come up as most probable states, various things. They're in the book, actually.
So the staircases are in there.
They're in the book.
They're in your solutions.
They may be. I'm not sure. I like your comment, but I won't say anything until I've actually looked for it. That's a very nice suggestion. Okay, so that just shows you that maybe these things aren't totally out to lunch, and this is in fact the context we used them for Jupiter, that there's a weak inverse cascade that makes the red spot, and we get a prior distribution which has anticyclonic skewness from deep convective intense plumes banging on the weather layer, which is the analog of the stratosphere on Jupiter, by the way. And out pops the Jupiter red spot through that procedure. But that's my favorite thing I like to show people, but instead I'm going to show a different application because Bjorn required me to. Okay. So this is more of an application of where I thought it would be fun to show everyone similar ideas of where angular momentum enters. So what I'll be talking about is work of a former postdoc and myself. I'm very fond of this guy. Sorry, he went to Wall Street, actually. He's a talented fellow named Mark D. Batista. Of course, he's making 5 times the salary I make. I don't have a small salary. I shouldn't feel too sorry for him. I'm exaggerating. Not 5 times, only a factor of 2.
Was that upscale transfer or downscale?
I leave it for you. I'm hoping he's going to make a contribution to the credits.
One point I hate to back up just from your last slide, of course. Is the result you mentioned but didn't show that you could do this all through statistical mechanics involving just energy and density? That presumably can be immediately generalized to QG in 3 dimensions, just substituting potential density or not?
No, because, for example, with QG, it gets extremely subtle because if you think about QG in 3D, there are a whole bunch of conserved quantities. Since you don't have vertical motion, you've got a whole bunch of subsidiary insert quantities going into each layer. So that gets very subtle, in fact. And it's not the energy entropy theory I would advocate, actually. This is kind of a miracle of one sign vorticity, et cetera, why energy entropy happens. So to elaborate a little bit further, you might wonder, are the other conserved quantities important? And Harry's coming up. There is a 25-year-old controversy. How many other conserved quantities are important in equilibrium statistical mechanics. So what I did with Rafael Abramov, and it's chapter 15 of my book, it's reported there, we took an equilibrium statistical mechanics problem designed by Vladimir Zeitlin, where he figured out a special truncation of the fluid equations that has all the invariants you could imagine discretized. Then we figured out a new numerical method to integrate those equations. And what you'll find out in that context is the third moment is extremely important. You can't get away with just the energy of the entropy. So that's part of the building.
But all the others?
All the others turn out to be statistically irrelevant. And the third moment is the kind of thing Turkington and I would push, actually. So there's a nice serendipity. It's in the book. Right?
I hate to distract you. There's a third moment.
Absolutely. The skewnesses are playing a big role And it's the same story with Jupiter. So I'm just trying to entice you. So that
I brought
was,
your book with me. Actually, I bought it.
Okay. So homework exercise for you. Read chapter 15 tomorrow. I'll quiz you on it. Okay. Okay, so now I want to show you the role of angular momentum, and it's in a paper in Theoretical and Computational Fluids from 2001, and some related papers in Journal of Physical Oceanography in the Labrador Sea Group's special volume in the Journal of Physical Oceanography, which, is, as I said, was their swan song in the field after they got me interested. So that's why I switched to hurricanes now. Okay, so here we have the two-layer quasi-geostrophic models. So we have two layers. These are the ones where the hetons exist as point vortices. So you have advection of two potential vorticities in each layer. There's the bulk average motion in the fluid, which is how the fluid goes in total. That's called the barotropic component. Mike just talked about that earlier. Then we have the things that transport heat. This difference is essentially a difference quotient that was work things out, which will tell you what the temperature is, and so you're transporting heat by the difference. And the important thing to realize is the barotropic one doesn't see the rotational effects, which are encoded by F, and they're screening of the heat transported guys through this Rossby radius. And in the applications I'm going to be talking about, the Rossby radius is tiny. So now, if you didn't know equilibrium, if you didn't know this maximum entropy principle, you'd try to do equilibrium statistical mechanics on the system. So you'd have a conserved quantity that's the Hamiltonian, which is the energy, sum of what happens in the two layers. It's the sum of the kinetic and potential energies. You'd have a linear momentum, and then you'd have an angular momentum. So we're going to ignore linear momentum, just pick our coordinate system so it's not there. This is the object Mike has been emphasizing and, of course, is extremely important for hurricanes. Then we'll also have the two circulations. Those are the conserved quantities. Now, what you can do is, if you think about it, there are a few length scales that are important. Angular momentum is one length scale, has units of this. Circulation has these units, same units as viscosity. So you'll end up with two length scales, the angular momentum length scale divided by the barotropic circulations length scale, and you'll end up with the Rossby radius length scale. So good things to keep in mind for the non-experts, because the non-dimensional regimes you're in, we didn't look at this work of the hurricane regime. This might even say something about toy models for hurricanes, actually, that could be interesting, I think. So, let's see. So what we do is, now we're going to do like Stummel and people did, our elementary particles, if you remember, that cooled everything. We're going to have value minus one in the upper troposphere and one, I mean, minus one in the upper layer of the ocean and plus one in the bottom layer. So what we do is, in standard point vortex dynamics people might be familiar with, we'd say the vorticities have constant strength in the upper layer and in the lower layer in our sums of delta function. Then we can write the velocity stream functions in the upper and lower layer in terms of the two Green's functions of the barotropic and baroclinic parts. And then you get a very beautiful Hamiltonian system which has the two-layer analog of point vortices in it. Special exact solutions of those are the hetons. So that's what I said here. So you get a finite dimensional Hamiltonian system. And angular momentum are the conserved quantities, and circulations are the conserved quantities. And here it's the conserved quantities of the system. Okay. Now, how to do empirical statistical mechanics. I want to contrast that with the point vortex dynamics Anzager did. I'll show you how to shortcut it very quickly here, and then I'll look at its predictions. So first of all, if you've got an energy and you've got other conserved quantities, the most probable probability measure for doing measurements, you can again use information theory to do this if you didn't know statistical mechanics. It's a beautiful idea of going back to Jane in 1957, and you'll be led to the same Gibbs measure people talk about. So here's all the positions of all the potential things in your vortex system. Here's the Lagrange multiplier of the energy constraint. Here's the Lagrange multiplier of the circulation constraint. And then it's normalized by what's called the finite n-dimensional partition function. So this has got to be a finite integral. So Zn has to be finite. The first thing you have to realize is this is very non-trivial to have Zn finite. To have Zn finite, look at these guys. You've got omega 1 x1 squared, omega 2 x2 squared. Is this ever going to be a finite integral if omega 1 and omega 2 have different signs? There's no way. It's going to be plus infinity, even as a finite dimensional integral, unless omega 1 and omega 2 have interesting sign, have the same sign. So one condition you need for finiteness is the sign of alpha has to be the same as the sign of omega 1 and omega 2 in order to have this converge. A subtle, more subtle condition, which goes back to the negative temperature states Ansager started, is for this system you also need the potential temperature to be bigger than this combination, to be bigger than minus 2. Otherwise, the logarithmic singularity will kill you in creating infinity. Okay, but what I want to focus on is if you remember anything from doing the finite dimensional Gibbs ensemble, it's this. There's a prediction that if you're expecting things to equilibrate and not have vortices just run off to infinity, you'd better have the signs of omega 1 and omega 2 be the same. Now, how to shortcut and do equilibrium statistical mechanics? Well, we have one-point probability distributions for each layer. Here's my relative entropy. And now, the dumbest possible prior distribution. So this is the main point I wanted to show you. What would be our dumbest possible prior distribution we could think of for our vortices? Well, without any other knowledge about where the vortices are located, we just put them down randomly with equal probability at each point. This demystifies what Ansager was doing, by the way. If you apply this empirical theory to Ansager's point vortex case, you'll get his famous equation. Just by picking the prior distribution to be at each location, uniform probability distribution with a delta function in the vertical giving you your value omega. Here we have a value in the upper layer, omega 1. Here we have a value in the lower layer, omega 2. Make those choices. Demystify those choices. Write down the same calculations. Do an exercise in the calculus of variations to maximize the entropy subject to constraints of angular momentum and circulation. You then get Lagrange multipliers for them. And out will pop a prediction. And that prediction will be the following thing. You get coarse-grained one-point statistics then, will be given here in terms of your prior probability distribution. And out pops a very beautiful mean field equation. And here it is. So the coarse-grained large-scale state is computed in this case by solutions of your mean field equation. So what you need are omega 1 and omega 2 to be the same sign and the same sign as alpha. And here's your coarse-grained large-scale prediction without doing anything. So now I want to show you what you get first. So if you ignore the baroclinic part, you look at what's called zero inverse temperature, this is confinement due to angular momentum. So the angular momentum constraints, if they have the same sign, confine your solution. And this length scale is roughly the length scale I wrote down as the units of angular momentum. On the other hand, if you look at very high energies, what you get is an incredibly intense vortex that's within the angular momentum. Okay, those are examples. Now I want to show you some numerical experiments that John Marshall and Sonia Legge did, reported in 1993, that predate any of these discussions of the equilibrium statistical theory, which DiBattista and I did in 2001. Remember, a key feature of the equilibrium statistical theory was that angular momentum confinement, you'd only even get a finite dimensional finite Gibbs measure if the upper and lower layers had the same sign. This has bearing on a preconditioning environment, as I'll now show you. So what John Marshall and Sonia Leck did was solve these two-layer point vortex equations where they had localized disk cooling. And what they found, and this is the only important thing, is so they initialized with bunches of hetons locally and watched what happened. What is a heton? A heton has plus vorticity in the upper layer, minus vorticity in the bottom layer. So we got random numbers of things that have plus vorticity in the upper layer, minus vorticity in the lower layer. Are those things that are associated with a finite Gibbs measure? No. And guess what? When they did their experiments, these things propagated like crazy. So what they showed was, this is some simulations, what you should see is this was their cooling region. It was always transporting heat, and this is what fascinated them. It always transported heat away from the region. So you see all these heat engines going away from the cooling region. No angular momentum confinement. Well, I was giving lectures on this in my course at Courant, and Shang Lim, who's from RPI, down the road in Albany, came to these lectures that particular year. And I mentioned to him that what must happen is what you see are dipole tilted clusters transporting heat away from this disk cooling region all the time. And if you look at them, there's always, if there are five of these, there are six of these. There's always an even odd number. So I said he's an expert in Kolmogorov-Arnold-Moser theory in various ways for point vortices. So what I told him was I suspected that we could do a perturbation theory with exact solutions and prove the following thing. That there exist sets of positive measure in the n-dimensional phase space, if n is big, where there are these clusters going away. So it's not just the fact equilibrium statistical mechanics says there are no equilibrium solutions, and we'll prove there's a set of positive measure that won't allow any. And that's actually what we managed to prove. It's a little paper in geophysical and astrophysical fluids from 1999. Now, I want to contrast that with what John Marshall and Sonia Leck did, and now we think of Mike's talk and the preconditioning environment of hurricanes, that you have a certain kind of preconditioned vortex. And of course, there's a big debate what kinds of preconditioned vortices lead to genesis and don't. And that's part of the fun. And here you have the same problem. So what Leck and Marshall did in 98 was repeat their same experiments. And there's a similar issue. The places where there's deep open ocean convection in the world's ocean often have preconditioned domed isopycnals due to topography or various other effects. So what they said is, let's put in a rim barotropic preconditioning current. Now, these are bad slides, and it's their fault, not mine. They put in a barotropic preconditioned current. And what you see is these are comparable times to what they showed earlier. All the stuff stays confined. These point vortices don't run away and transport heat. They were seeding them with hetons like crazy, but the baroclinic instability was suppressed and confined. And so what we can do is exactly get a similar confinement by using equilibrium statistical mechanics. So we'll predict that. We'll predict that this confinement must happen. So very quickly, I've done for you all the things. We have our equilibrium statistical solutions with energy, angular momentum, circulation. What we do is have a pre-existing vortex. And then the effect of hetons will be to change the conserved quantities of your pre-existing vortex by adding upper layer anomalies that are proportional to one sign and lower layer anomalies the minus sign. That's your Hecon dipole. We're going to keep the angular momentum the same because these individually change it not at all, very negligibly. We could have varied that. That wouldn't change our answers. We compute numerically the solutions of the mean field equations. And what we get is the statistical theory predicts that eventually all vorticity will pair up and propagate away from the cooling region if you don't have the ambient flow. That's what I told you. And now with the ambient flow, it'll predict exactly what they see in their simulations. The PV and temperature anomalies get confined within an angular momentum radius. There's a suppression of the baroclinic instability. The temperature anomalies widen, and the velocity anomalies reinforce the cyclonic flow for all the tests we've done. So that's a prediction without doing any of the work of exactly what they saw from their simulation. So I can tell you which parameters govern it. I don't think that that's important for this lecture. So now here's the anomalies. So here's the heat anomaly confined here as we change the ambient preconditioning environment. And then here's the construction of a tight rim current. And by the way, these are oceanographically reasonable values. So here you see with various preconditioned rim currents, the velocity confined to a very intense vortex, just like in Mike's case, just like for a hurricane, the vortex intensity is largest, of course, vorticity intensity out there. So there's the analog of an eyewall here. Okay. And they should from this scale, and I can't help you. What we changed is the baroclinicity of the ambient flow a little bit. It's a detail that's irrelevant for this talk, the amount of information I'm giving. Okay. Now the next thing I want to do is in my last 15 minutes talk to you about ensemble prediction. Okay. So very briefly, what I want to talk about is how to do ensemble prediction. And my gadget I start with is the relative entropy again. So just a review. So given P and pi, this gadget measures the average lack of information in the probability density pi relative to P. And here are its mathematical properties. Now what I want to show you is how you can use it for ensemble predictions. Okay. So now here's a completely different kind of set of issues and problems where information theory is a very attractive developing tool to use. At first, GCMs, for example, can be written as a huge system of ODEs, maybe on a 10 million or a billion variable phase space, or several billion depending on your resolution phase space. So what we've got are general complex models represented by ODEs. Now, the way people actually do predictions of weather is not to look at one solution and run it. What they say is we have so many positive Lyapunov exponents. This is such an incredibly hard, chaotic system. And by the way, in my 25 years of being involved in all kinds of engineering applications and turbulence, combustion, aerodynamics, blah, 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 the hardest engineering problems I know are the coupled atmosphere ocean system. This is really a beast, which you're a mathematician and don't realize it. So what people then do is really begin with a probabilistic description. They have a mean state, and then what they do is generate, in various ingenious ways, ensemble perturbations about that mean state. So in a perfect ensemble case, what you have is an ensemble, a statistical state of the atmosphere initially, or the coupled atmosphere-ocean system. And then you'd say, okay, what's the big deal? We know how to evolve that, given that ODE system. We solve a linear equation to evolve it. That's called the Liouville equation. You're not a mathematician. The Liouville equation, of course, is a linear equation, but unfortunately it's on a 10 million or a billion dimensional phase space. So you can't really use it for anything. You can use it for a basis for approximations. So what people do is they sample this distribution, they take its mean and some other solutions, and build an empirical distribution by following a small number of trajectories. And this is an ensemble prediction. So they might like in a perfect ensemble to follow this exact distribution. They can't do it and instead generate a finite ensemble. So R is the ensemble size. Typically, in practical real-time predictions, a 20 or a 50 member ensemble is right out the envelope of where you are for everything. So there are good questions for mathematicians about what to do with small ensemble sizes. So here are some of the list of questions for quantifying uncertainty in an ensemble prediction you might want to know. How much lack of information is contained in a given prediction strategy? So traditional predictions measure the mean, which is the ensemble mean, and the ensemble spread, which is involved with the second moment. So if you do that, if you had a perfect ensemble and you do a finite realization, what's the additional information in the truth? When does an ensemble prediction exhibit bimodality in some variables? So there are at least two different scenarios of significant change predicted. This is an enormously practical thing. You care in a long-range prediction. With how much statistical confidence can you say that there are two different routes going on, say 20 days later? In a given dynamical system, which subsets of variables are more predictable than others? For long-term climate prediction, you'd like to know, are you going to beat the historical climate record? That should be your prior, you'd think. How can you tell whether you're beating the historical climate record? So these are all questions, and they can all be answered by using the information theory measures to provide a framework. So for example, if you want to know how much your finite ensemble goes compared to, say, an ensemble strategy where you just measure the mean in the second moment, and you have the perfect predictability distribution, you'd like to look at how much additional information is contained in P versus PE, or how much information is lacking in PE, which is the same thing. Now, if you pick a Gaussian ensemble prediction strategy and you build your empirical prediction strategy, how much information have you lost by, say, not including skewnesses and other moments? And then for long-term climate prediction, long-term prediction, you might want to know, when do you have more information than the climatology in some variables for your ensemble prediction? So now you can write down this gadget, but if you think about it, you've got one heck of a problem. No one in their right mind is going to write down this integral over Rn, where n is a million or a billion or something, and compute this integral. There is no way you're going to calculate that. So this is where the fun begins. So the fun begins with how to make rational approximations and estimators for this that are computationally efficient and can be used, and how to quantify them with small ensemble sizes. So this is where our fun began. And that's it. So how can you numerically compute or approximate for a complex system with many degrees of freedom and a large subset of variables? So here's the strategies we take. Are there computationally feasible and mathematically rigorous strategies, at least to determine lower bounds for this, that you can get either analytically or by a very rapid numerical procedure? So this is work that we've done at the CAOS group and the CAOS, the Center for Atmosphere Ocean Science, our acronym is CAOS. Richard Kleeman and myself and a number of postdocs. And this is an older slide. There's, as I said, more work being done. We've applied these ideas to low-frequency variability. We've applied them to quantifying predictability with small sample estimation. I'll show you an example right now from that. here is where we developed the calculus for how you could actually get lower bounds by certain kind using some inequalities of information theory in a rapid algorithm. We've applied these ideas to geophysical turbulence. And Richard Kleeman, these aren't particularly in order, Richard Kleeman introduced this idea of using the relative entropy to predict how much information there is beyond the climate in a very important paper. And if you read chapter 14 of my book, you'll see some of the ideas in their simplest form put forward. Here's basically what we do. In an ensemble prediction, let's generalize what people do with the mean and the variance and see if you can compute, say, the third moments and the fourth moment, say. So you might know some low-order variables for a subset of variables in a many-dimensional system. So what you need to do is come up with a theory for bounds, and that's what we do. So we use moments of order 4, 2 when we can use the exact formulas of the Gaussian case, and moments of order 4 when we want to detect non-Gaussianity. There's a very nice math theory associated with it. I won't show you that. But here's the idea. When our prior distribution is a Gaussian, here's an example of the bounds. You can prove that for a Gaussian prior distribution, using a Gaussian PG is a lower estimator bound for using moments for the distribution that are higher than the Gaussian, namely, say, fourth moment. And of course, these are lower bounds for having the truth. And the way you could get these guys is to solve the maximum entropy moment problem. So what we did is build a very efficient algorithm in a few space dimensions to solve the maximum entropy moment problem. That was work Rafael Abramov did with me, which is not a trivial task numerically.
So how are you collapsing this
billion dimensions we can't do, but we can do dynamical cores of low frequency variability. We apply it to a P21 truncation of a barotropic model. So first we say, what are interesting low frequency variables? Then, given those low frequency variables, we do an ensemble prediction and project the data on the moments of those and ask which variables do you need? So the collapse occurs in the following way. I can use two-dimensional estimators, so if I have an n-dimensional system, I can run massively in parallel, offline, two-dimensional estimators very efficiently for all the degrees of freedom of that system. Of course, that'll stop when n is 100 or n is 1,000, but it'll give you an estimate of those, some large number of variables. So it's not that we're limited to one variable or two variables, but so there's whether those estimates are good enough for the whole phase space, one has to think about. And of course, they're never going to be good for your million mode model. So let me illustrate a bimodal prediction in my last 5 minutes.
Much more concise and much, it doesn't require being near equilibrium, doesn't require anything.
This is just a math theory for bounds. It's true always under suitable hypotheses. No tricks. Okay, so this is a model that will come up, I'm sure, on Thursday, since this is a very popular model. By the way, here's a comment for the mathematicians. Everyone in math thinks Lorentz's 63 model is the model, this three-mode model. That's Lorentz is famous for about 15 simplified models in atmospheric science. And his probably least physically relevant model is the Lorentz 63 model, by the way. It's the lousiest model for what the atmosphere is. However, it's a very good model for demonstrating that a three-degree of freedom system can have chaotic dynamics. That's just an aside. And one of Lorentz's probably currently most popular model, and it has huge applications, and I've seen it used like crazy for people doing data assimilation with carry He used it in a nice, Lorenz did, for targeted observations. We've used it for this problem, and I've used it for fluctuation dissipation. John Harlan will get his lecture, I know, uses for data assimilation. So this is called the Lorenz 96 model. And this one, believe it or not, this harmless looking set of finite difference equations, which are a very bad numerical approximation to the Invissenberger's equation, with damping and forcing, are an incredibly nice cartoon for looking at one latitude of the mid-latitude atmosphere and using it as a simple model for that. And simply because it has analogs of the periodicity in here, it's got a bad and linearly unstable waves, it's got westward phase velocities like Rossby waves and eastward group velocities like actual weather systems. It's a really neat thing. It's discussed in those papers, it's discussed in my book. And if you play with F, Lorenz took the value of F to be 8. Here's what F equals 8 looks like. If you pick the equilibrium stat-mech solutions that occur without dissipation and forcing, here's what you get. Here's F equals 4, where it looks like simple wave trains, and here's F equals 6, where there's some more turbulent wave trains. So now what I want to do right at the end of my talk is not tell you the theory, but tell you exactly how you can quantify predictability with small sample size. And when are there two routes for prediction or not? So this is a 40-mode model. So what we did, we generated what in the prediction literature is called a super ensemble. This is a statistically stationary solution. So we picked 20 different well-separated initial conditions. And then we did a predictability experiment for each of the 20 ones. And what we did was we picked a 25-member ensemble in one, a 50-member ensemble in another, a 100-member ensemble in another, and a 200-member ensemble in another. We have hidden behind this the theory of small ensemble size uses of information theory to quantify certainty. Now what we can do is, so we're asking, is this particular prediction, and now this is for the climate variable itself in the Lorenz 96 model, the zero mode, we're asking, is the prediction going to be bimodal in this model and can we trust it? So here's time 4 in the model. And this is with Lorenz's classical value. Now here's something we wouldn't have as advanced information. What we see is, but this will give us a guideline. Here is the 50, 100, and 200 member ensembles. And here's the measure of average non-Gaussianity using information theory. So we took the fourth moments and compared it to the Gaussian. And what we see is an enormous spike at unit 4 here. In the 25, and that enormous spike of non-Gaussianity is well preserved. All of those, it's converged, so to speak. Certainly not converged with the 25-member ensemble. Hidden here is a finite kind of exotic statistical criterion to say, can you trust with 95% confidence a bimodal prediction? Well, here we already see with an ensemble member of size 50, we can trust a bimodal prediction with this much confidence. As the ensemble size gets to be 100, we can trust it even more, and as the ensemble size is 200, we can trust it more. So this is an unambiguous mathematical statistical test using information theory. So the upshot is we can trust bimodal prediction that it's going to happen. Let me show you now what it looks like. So there are going to be two routes as we went on in time in the L96 model, and here it is. As promised, so here's, if you were going to be using the standard mean and variance Gaussian predictor, you'd be predicting this at time 4. So that's the critical time of non-Gaussianity. Here would be the Gaussian predictor. Here would be the Gaussian predictor. Now, if you take the moment estimator that takes advantage of the first 4 moments, you get this. And notice it's more or less converged with 50 to 100 to 200, as the theory tells you. Now, in this particular case, the mathematics said you can't really trust the 25 member ensemble, but here it hasn't done a bad job. In the same paper, we have an example I don't have time to show you. It's if and only if. We can show we have cases where there's no statistical confidence at a 25 member ensemble. You'd be fooled that it was bimodal, and other further increases in the ensemble, the bimodality disappears. That doesn't happen here, but that's what the math theory will tell you too. So that's another non-traditional use of information theory, and a rather important one. And this is an exotic application because it's easier to detect with small ensemble sizes bimodality than it is to detect near Gaussianity. That's an important ingredient.